Victorian Manchester.
A knife attack leaves a teenage gang member fatally wounded on a Manchester street. A victim of a gang feud and a turning point in the war on gangs.
In another part of the city, a man is shot dead attending the wake of his friend, the victim of another gang murder. A drive-by shooting in broad daylight, which brought about the downfall of one of Britain's most dangerous gangs.
These two gangland murders shocked the whole country. But although they took place in the same city, they took place over 100 years apart.
We're going to be looking at gangland Britain, where we'll see that gang culture has been with us far longer than you might think.
We're going to investigate some of Britain's gangs and discover how you joined them, what they stood for, and how they fell.
In this program, we're exploring Manchester's gangs to see what they were and what they've become. For over 100 years, Manchester has had a deep-rooted gang culture. We're going to be comparing two Manchester gangs whose crimes so shocked both the public and the authorities, they each brought about radical changes in the fight against organised crime. I'm going to be looking at the Gooch Gang, who were active until only a few years ago. They tortured and killed without a second thought, and were responsible for around two dozen cold-blooded murders.
I'm going to be investigating the Scuttlers, a name that sent fear through the streets of Manchester over 100 years ago. One murder in particular caused such outrage that the Home Secretary demanded the Mayor of Manchester put an end to gang violence in the city. And just to show you what they look like, here are a couple of Scuttlers from Victorian Manchester. With their scarves and their almost gelled down hair, like the Perry Boys from the 1980s. They look so young, just baby-faced teenagers. We talk about teenage gangs with knives today. It's obviously nothing new. Victorian Manchester looks like a labyrinth on the map. So I want to get out there and take a look around to get a better idea of what went on back then. Long before there were hoodies and scallies, there were the Scuttlers, the first youth cult. I'm about to meet a man who I hope can tell me a little bit about them. Andrew Davis is a historian and author who has researched the gangs of Manchester. So, Andrew, tell me about the Scuttlers. What were the Scuttlers?
The Scuttlers were gang members. They were young lads, working-class lads, aged in their teens, more or less from the age of leaving school up to sort of 20, 21, and Scuttler was a very specific term. It meant you were a gang member, it meant you had a certain look. It's a slang term with its origins on the streets.
So what would they do? Would they be stealing, or were they running gambling, or...?
Scuttling gangs really are territorial gangs. They're neighbourhood or street gangs, and really they're fighting gangs rather than criminal gangs. They're usually named after the street, maybe the thoroughfare where they would gather on the corners. So it would be an area-based name. So you might have a gang from Hope Street, Salford. The most famous gangs had more exotic names. There was a gang from Ancoats from Bengal Street who went under the name the Bengal Tigers. Wow. So they're looking to invest a little bit of glamour, something exotic, in their activities.
And is that all it was really about? Sort of just respect and power?
It's very much about pride in your area, and it's about pride in yourself and your friends as well. So a lot of this is about keeping young people from other districts outside what you define as your patch.
But what kind of people were they? They don't seem terribly poor.
They tended to be in work, but they're in pretty humdrum work. There's not a lot of educational prospects for them. There's no great employment prospect. But to be a Scuttler, to be a Bengal Tiger, that's
wow.
To be somebody.
Scuttlers became the first youth cult. They had a distinctive look. Short hair, but with a long fringe. Worn in a parting and plastered down with soap on the forehead over the left eye.
The
The dress signalled to everyone that a scuttler was no ordinary working-class lad, but a street fighter. It was one thing to look dandy and impressive, but some of their dress had other, more vicious functions. For example, these clogs, heavy, pointed, and with brass toe caps, good for close-up combat. Their belts were another part of their armoury. They would have a heavy brass buckle, which they'd sharpen along the edge, so it became like a blade. They'd also bang nails or bolts through the end to add more weight when swung. It was said that a hit from one of these could split a man's skull. Tell me about scuttlers going into other scuttlers' territory and how dangerous that was.
Well, if one band of scuttlers cross the boundary into another gang's districts, that's an outright challenge. And really, the local lads are obliged to respond, and if they don't, they lose a lot of face.
And was the fighting just random, just people just getting angry and attacking people, or was there was an order to the way they fought?
I think it's very, very targeted. One of the things that you realise about scuttlers is they all know each other. The gangs would actually chalk the threat or the invitation to fight. They'd chalk the challenge either on a wall or maybe on the pavement, so there would be a day and a time, Saturday, 3 o'clock, Adelphi against Greengate. So it really is battling by appointment. They're very often carrying and they're using knives as well. But it's very, very rare that anybody gets killed. So generally what they're looking to do is to maim or to scar.
Why didn't they kill each other as gangs do nowadays?
I think maybe it's a sense that they don't want the stakes to be too high. These are young lads who are fighting for the thrill of it and to kind of burnish their reputations.
They still want to go home to their mums.
Exactly. It really wasn't part of their code to be looking to kill.
Imagine back then as a lad growing up around here. You're in your early teens, you had a job. Not a particularly interesting job, a boring one in a factory. At least you had money in your pocket. Whereas today, you'd go home and play a war game on a computer. Back then, you went out on the streets and did the real thing. You strutted your stuff.
I'm off to see what scuttlers I can find in the archives.
What we've got here, Gary, is pictures of the time of the scuttlers that you're referring to.
So this is a book that would have been kept by one of the local detectives?
One of the officers. It's out of our archive collection. It's one of the officers' personal books, I think, and this is how we identified his operative thieves and vagabonds of the time.
This is wonderful, isn't it? I mean, look at these boys. They're so young, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
And they've got this particular scuttler's look, haven't they, with the silk pattern scarves and the soaked down fringes.
It's like hair gel of the day.
But I mean, what I can see, I mean, this boy here is 18, but he looks so young.
Mm-hmm.
They went down to about 14, didn't they? You could go to work at 14 at that age.
You left school at 12.
You left school at 12. Mm-hmm. I mean, it tells a sad story, but this is probably the earliest photographs of a British youth cult that predates everything, like the Teds and the Rockers.
Well before the Teddy Boys, that's just about my era.
You could see their fascination with clothes and look was very important to them.
The look, it was a uniform. They are in uniform, in effect. All the men dressed more or less the same, with the same sort of hairstyle, easily identifiable to themselves and to the other gangs.
That's wonderful, but also very sad.
Very sad. That's the scuttlers. There was the Bengal Tigers, 400 yards up the road. You had to live in Bengal Street in Ancoats to be a member of the Bengal Tigers. And they just fought each other.
I wonder what gang these guys were in.
Well, these are the scuttlers from Greengate, I think.
Greengate? Oh, this is the Greengate scuttlers, of course. Mm-hmm. Oh, and this is William Brooks, who apparently was an amazing fighter. Famous. I mean, he looks like it. He looks like he's taken a few blows as well.
Yeah. Not a sort of kid you'd like to come up against. He's a bit older than the others. He's 20.
And so small. 5'6", 5'4", 5'5".
Good material for the SAS today. Good street fighters.
Inside the Manchester Police Museum, photographs of some of the city's scuttlers have been preserved.
This is like a national portrait gallery of rogues and villains and probably innocent people as well. A lot of sadness in their eyes, and some of them have bravado, fear. But I think most of all there's a story of a life behind every one of these pictures that maybe we forget. And it's very evocative. It's very moving, actually. You can tell just by reading some of the articles from the time that the gangs were seen as an unknown tribe, almost a different race of people. This is from the Courier newspaper of 1892. Each member of a gang is as well known to an enemy by a common name as are the Red Indians known by their tribe. Apparently, there are no two gangs allied, and each are ready to declare war against another, the grievance of one member being a sufficient justification for a battle. On the same Wild West theme, written just a couple of years ago by Judge Mr. Justice Brian Langstaff, he says, "Manchester is not the Wild West, but many of you treated the streets as if it were. It appears not that much has changed in the last 100 years. I'm going to be looking at the Gooch Gang. They were one of the biggest and most dangerous in South Manchester. I'm off to hook up with a man to take me on a tour of the gang territories. Okay, we've pulled up here. We're meant to be meeting a man called Ben Black. He's changed his name for obvious reasons. He's going to tell me all about it. Firstly, mate, thank you very much for talking to me. I know this is difficult for you, but I wondered if you could just give me a brief overview of gang culture in Manchester.
Gang culture in Manchester started in about the 1980s. The modern gang culture as we know it, in terms of gangs of drug dealers, armed with guns, you could trace that back to the 1980s in the inner city areas. At the time, high unemployment, lots of young black men who found it very hard to get jobs and were basically socially excluded.
It's always a political climate. It seems to be the same political climate that brings gangs around.
Definitely. I mean, there was the riots in the early 80s, which was kind of a reaction against the politics of the time and the unemployment of the time. When crack cocaine started to come over, that became a source of income for them.
Drugs, for me, changed everything with gangs, because it was drugs that kind of turned those small gangs into big firms. It was where the money was, and that's where the gangs changed.
Definitely.
They became grown-ups.
They became grown-ups. They became more and more ruthless. The drugs trade was so lucrative that they were able to arm themselves.
So where would the Gooch Gang that we're looking at, where did they start?
The original gang had been called the Pepper Hill Gang. That was the name of a pub on the Alexandra Park estate, which is kind of heart of gang culture in the 80s, where the gangs came out of. These lads used to knock about Gooch Close, and they became known as the Gooch Gang.
How did a gang like the Gooches make their money? What would they have done?
They made their money from crack cocaine and heroin. Late 80s, early 90s, the Alexandra Park estate got turned into the busiest drugs market. Probably the busiest drugs market in Europe. Open-air drug dealing. And the Gooch were very active in that.
With so much money to be made, the Gooch Gang soon had competition. Their supremacy was challenged by other local outfits, like the Doddington Gang and the Longsight Crew. They became bitter rivals.
The Doddington were what the Pepper Hill Crew turned into.
So they were both after the same profit?
They were both after the same profits.
So it became territorial after a while?
Yeah.
Tried to make it territorial?
Yeah, it was territorial in the sense that you had the Gooch are now associated with kind of the western half of Moss Side and the western half of that area. The Doddington are associated with the east.
I mean, these are a scary bunch, aren't they? It's not. This isn't kids kind of fighting over street corners. This is a proper gang.
It's turned into that.
Yeah.
Certainly, you know, in the early days, they were very focused on making money from drugs. Mm. But as time's gone on, it has turned into kids with guns squabbling on street corners.
Right, yeah. The Gooch Gang formed a drug network that brought in around £2,000 a day. They armed themselves with guns and wiped out rival gang members, torturing and murdering them.
Now, this lot are grown-ups. One guy who sold drugs for got into a row about some money. So they took him out to the local forest. They tied him to a tree, held a gun to his head and said, "If you ever leave the gang, you're dead." And then they beat him unconscious. Nice.
This was the Gooch Gang leader, Colin Joyce, known as the General. And this is Lee Amos, the other top man.
They've been described by one senior copper as psychopaths who shoot for fun.
These guys were at war with the Doddington gang and the Longsight crew. And in 5 years of shooting, 250 people were wounded and 27 were killed. These tit-for-tat killings culminated in two brutal shootings. They would shock not only Manchester, but the whole country, becoming a landmark in gang violence and ultimately bringing about the downfall of the Gooch Gang.
Our story begins at 6:45, 15th of June 2007, right here on the corner of Anson Road, Longsight, South Manchester. A young man called Ukal Chin was gunned down in a roadside ambush.
I want to find out how this happened, how an innocent man got caught up in a gangland shooting.
So we're here on Anson Road. Ukal Chin got shot here, right?
Yeah. He was, he'd been driving about with some friends that day. Colin Joyce, one of the senior members of the Gooch Gang, was driving up and down looking for a Longsight crew member or associate to go after. Somewhere along Anson Road, he spots Ukal Chin. The vehicle that he's in draws parallel to the Renault that Ukal is driving and opens fire, and Ukal's killed. The likelihood is he was after Ukal.
Why? Because he thought he was part of Longsight?
Ukal came up in an area where gang membership is simply defined by who your friends are. Mm. You might have friends who are more involved than you are, but you become associated with their gang because they're your friends. They might be the friends that you went to primary school with. They might be the friends that you've grown up playing football with. But that's enough to label you, and if you happen to be driving these lands about on a particular day and your face becomes associated with them, then it's a question of perception. That was enough to get Ukal killed, unfortunately.
The horrors of gang warfare leave families destroyed. Not just the misery from the drugs they sell, but families torn apart by shootings and killings.
Can you tell me what happened on the day of Ukal's murder?
The day Ukal murder, I was in work as usual. And when I was in work, I get a phone call, but really it wasn't me getting the phone call, it was somebody else who I'm working with. Yeah. And they say to her, Ukal get shot. And I said, what? Ukal get shot? Yeah. And then they say, die. And I couldn't believe that was a shock to me. As I remember the day when he sat here and I sat there and we was talking, and he said to me, Mum, I'm going out, I'll be back in a minute. Mm-hmm. And that's the last word he said to me, and I always remember that.
The violence got worse. Knowing that there would be a funeral and a wake for Ukal Chin, the Gooch Gang waited and planned another attack for July 27th. The wake was to be held here, at Chin's family home in Frobisher Close, Longsight.
But the audacious Chicago-style shooting they all planned was going to be the gang's undoing.
It would be so horrific, it would kickstart a major offensive by the Manchester police to bring down the Gooch Gang.
In 1892, the Scuttlers' fighting was about to go to a new level that would shock the nation. The tension centred around Peter Kennedy, a young factory worker from the Lime Street gang of Scuttlers.
Kennedy had been persuaded to join the Lime Street Scuttlers, but his association with the gang came at a price. Each day after work at the dye factory, he would have to walk home through the slums that surrounded the Ashton and Rochdale canals, the territory of the Bradford Street gang.
Kennedy had bravado and confidence. He'd had confrontations with the Bradford Street gang before, but this time, one of them would single him out in a violent attack which would change the rules of street fighting.
This is an old map of Manchester, and I'm just trying to find where it would have been,
where the incident happened.
And I can see Mill Street here on the corner of Great Ancoat Street, but everything looks very different on this old map. I mean, here it's just back-to-back housing, a real warren by the look of it.
But, you know, this is what the scuttlers fought over. And you had to know which area was which, otherwise you could get into trouble. A bit like LA today. You don't want to stray into the wrong area.
But on one Saturday in 1892, Peter Kennedy did just this. It would cost him his life.
So, Andrew, this is just off of Bengal Street, and this was the most dangerous area in the whole of Manchester.
This was, I guess you would say, this was the heart of gangland, really, in the 1880s, 1890s.
Tell me about our victim, Peter Kennedy. Who was he?
Peter Kennedy's in a difficult position because he's associated with one gang, the Lime Street Boys, but he's working in Ancoats in the territory of the Bradford Street. The gangs have fallen out over girls, and this seems to be a really common occurrence when gangs fall out. It's often one of the allegations that is made. A young lad from the Bradford Street gang, Billy Willen, another 16-year-old, and he seems to be nursing a grudge against Peter Kennedy.
Over a girl?
Yeah.
William Willen had tussled with Peter Kennedy before. They'd had words, but neither side had landed a punch. Now, William Willen decided that a fight would settle it. At around midday, Peter Kennedy finished his shift and, taking some backup with him, he set off for home.
At 12:30 on the Saturday afternoon, Willen was here waiting for Kennedy with a dozen of his men. Kennedy came along the street from work with four of his compatriots, plus one of the Bengal Tigers. That should have given him access home. But when he got to this corner, he was surrounded by the Bradford Street gang. Kennedy said, "What's it to be then?" That was the prelude to any scuttle, meaning what weapons, how many men to fight how many men. Willen held out an open clasped knife and said, "Anything you like." Immediately, the Bradford Street gang attacked with their belts, and Kennedy ran back up the street, chased by Willen. And Willen stabbed him in the side with his knife. Up until now, the scuttlers had followed a code with their fights. They'd always been organised and scheduled. They would chalk up on a wall when the next fight was due and agree the sides and even the weapons. But not this time. This was an unexpected and fatal attack.
Talking about rules and codes, 100 years on, there aren't any rules. Now violence can erupt, even in broad daylight, on an ordinary street like Canton Road.
23-year-old father, Yu Kao Chin, was shot dead by the Gooch Gang's leader, Colin Joyce, and his number two, Lee Amos. Yu Kao's car was peppered with 9mm bullets. Yu Kao was killed because Amos and Joyce believed he was a member of a rival gang, the Longsight Crew.
After Yu Kao Chin's funeral, a wake was held at his family home in Longsight. It was there on the 27th of July 2007 the Gooch Gang decided to strike again. They knew that there would be a number of Longsight Gang members at the wake.
We're at Frobisher Close. Just talk me through what happened here.
About 6 weeks after Yu Kao Chin was killed, his friends and family came together for a funeral. Afterwards, there was a wake at his mother's address, probably about 80 or 90 people were milling about the house, many of them women and children. Three cars head down Markfield Avenue to the junction with Frobisher Close and open fire on people at the scene. Tyrone Gilbert was hit by a bullet from a handgun and ran a short distance to an alleyway before slumping to his death. It's likely that Tyrone Gilbert was actually the person who they were after that night, even though they opened fire indiscriminately.
Why were they looking for him?
Lee Amos, his brother Stephen, gets killed. They probably suspected that Tyrone had been there. They just had a score to settle.
Having buried her son and returned home to hold the wake, Yu Kao Chin's mother, Vivian, now witnessed another horror.
I mean, you had something really terrible happen, right?
Yeah.
Yuka's wake?
It was the wake after the funeral. Been to the hall, came to the house, was in here cooking. I heard, like, people dashing in, and I was saying, "Oh, what's going on? What's going on?" And I said, "Everyone running upstairs." I said, "No, you can't go upstairs." And they said, they're shooting outside. My daughter and my small son was out there. And the guy come out and in the car, point the gun out and call, like, whatever name we call and start firing the shot.
Yeah.
And, you know, people came to the house just to still play their respect. I was there, like, eating and, like, playing music and things like that, and they just came and shoot up the street.
There was genuine fear and outrage at the shooting, but the gunman made a bad mistake. They came here to Firethorn Avenue to pick up the getaway cars. But what they didn't realise is they left a piece of evidence on here that would prove vital in the case against them and give the police a much-needed lead to bring them to justice.
In 1892, a 16-year-old boy called Peter Kennedy is knifed without warning and left lying in a Manchester street. While Kennedy lay fatally wounded on the road, his attacker, William Willen, flees. Willen soon meets up with a mate of his called Jimmy Hands. Willen then gives him his wage packet on condition that Hands stashes the murder weapon for him. He gives him only one instruction: if you get copped, don't tell on me. But things wouldn't work out quite as Willen had hoped.
What happens the next day?
Billy Willen, who's a very young lad, he's got no criminal record, he's probably not taken part in many of these
fights. He's broken the rules, hasn't he?
That's it, he's broken the code. So there's a real danger now that a 16-year-old boy is going to die. This is going to bring a lot of police attention
right
down on the gangs. The Bradford Street Scutlers will be getting very nervous about this. And they clearly decide amongst themselves that Billy Willen's gone too far.
Instead of keeping quiet, the following day at 3 p.m, Jimmy Hands walked into Canal Street Police Station in Ancoats and handed in a clasp knife. He told the desk sergeant that the weapon had been used by William Willen to stab Peter Kennedy.
What happens to Willen? Does he get arrested straight away?
Yeah, he's arrested on the Monday morning, and Peter Kennedy rallies for a few days, but then his condition deteriorates. He dies a couple of weeks after the incident on Great Ancoats Street. And, of course, what that then means is that Billy Willen and two of his friends are on trial for murder.
The incident awakened everyone to the dangers of gang fighting. Even the gangs themselves thought that a line had been crossed and that Willen had gone too far. In the Scuttlers' pubs across the neighbourhood, the Willen and Kennedy incident became a hot topic.
So this place would have been full of gossip of the incident?
Yeah, it would. This was a Scuttlers' drinking den, really. This was one of the headquarters of the Bengal Tigers. And in the little neighbourhood pubs like this, right through Manchester and Salford, the fight between the Bradford Street Scuttlers and the Lime Street Boys would have been the topic of conversation.
So what happened?
I think the evidence against Billy Willen was just too strong. And what was really unusual in this case, members of his own gang had actually testified towards his prosecution. This was a really rare thing. You'd hardly ever find a Scuttler willing to give evidence against a rival, never mind against one of his friends. And I think what that really tells us is that the Scuttlers themselves felt that something had gone wrong here, that Billy Willen had gone too far, that he'd done something that even a Scuttler shouldn't have done.
The case against Willen hinged on the testimony of his own gang. Along with two others, he was accused of murder. So these three guys were facing the death sentence at the age of 16. What was the QC for the prosecution asking for?
He's trying to persuade the jury to convict for murder. He wants the most severe penalty of the law.
Now, this trial was very emotional, wasn't it?
It was. Billy Willen, in particular, was absolutely terrified. We've got to remember that Billy Willen's very young. He's not been in trouble with the police before. He's never been in court prior to this incident. And now he stood there literally trembling with his life at stake.
There were a lot of tears, I understand.
There were. I think he was on the verge of breaking down. And when the jury returned their verdict was that William Willen was guilty of murder. And he panicked, he began pleading with the judge, and he was actually held down by two police officers while the judge donned the black cap to pass the death sentence.
His girlfriend thought that was the lot for Willen, didn't she?
She did, and a week after he'd been condemned at the Assizes, his sweetheart, Hannah Robin, was in court herself with three of her girlfriends. They'd been arrested for scuttling with belts. Probably this is yet another of the tit-for-tat incidents between the two gangs, but Hannah caused quite a stir in court because as she's in the dock and the police are giving an account of her arrest, a police inspector demands that she pull up the sleeve of her blouse to show the court. She's obliged to do that, and when she pulls the sleeve up, it shows a tattoo in loving remembrance of William Willen.
Wow, that's love.
South Manchester 2007, with Tyrone Gilbert left sprawled on the ground and others lying injured, Yu Kao-chin's funeral wake had been turned into a gangland target. The Gooch gang got away in three vehicles. One of them was found abandoned a couple of miles away. As the men made their escape, a balaclava became snagged on some barbed wire in Firethorn Avenue. Was left behind along with a pair of gloves.
That balaclava provided a DNA match that linked one of the gang, Aaron Campbell, into the shooting. And from then on, police knew that the Gooch gang were involved in this murder.
This was now an opportunity for the police to try and bring down Manchester's most dangerous gang. A massive investigation got underway, but ensuring their convictions would be a protracted and complex challenge. Convictions were only possible with witnesses, and witnesses in gang trials are very hard to come by.
It was probably the biggest, the most expensive investigation of its kind and prosecution of its kind ever mounted in Manchester.
Once they arrested a couple of them, did they find that more witnesses came forward?
There was a lady who had her home had been turned into a kind of Gooch gang safe house. And what she tended to find was that wherever she moved, gang members would sort of follow her. And so the Gooch gang members basically would converge on her home, use it to store guns, use it to chop up drugs, and keep her sweet and keep her and her brother sweet with Class A drugs. She realised that enough was enough, and as police started picking people up, they were among some of the kind of Gooch gang associates who came forward and started providing bits of information that linked the Gooch gangs in with heavy gun crime and drug dealing. Former members of the gang were able to come forward and talk about things that they'd been asked to buy in preparation for an attack.
50,000 pages of evidence were scrutinised by prosecution lawyers, including 80,000 mobile phone calls and texts. But the hardest part was persuading witnesses to talk. The police gave them the protection they needed. Some were even relocated with new identities. The most vulnerable ones were those closest to the gang. Some had to confess to their own criminality. Some of them were engaged in gang activity, like drug dealing and possession of firearms. Many witnesses were stuck in a cycle of crime by helping the gang. One witness talked about the gang coming into their house to package up drugs while passing around handguns. Another told how they'd been asked to store a getaway car in their garage and destroy the logbook in the days leading up to Tyrone Gilbert's murder. One of the defendants, Narada Williams, managed to get hold of a mobile phone in his prison cell and ring one of the witnesses to try and put pressure on him.
But witnesses did come forward, and the case went to trial here in Liverpool. It was one of the longest and the largest in the history of Greater Manchester Police.
In the courtroom, two leaders of the Gooch gang, Joyce and Amos, shouted and hurled abuse at the witnesses and the court.
The families of Yu Kao and Tyrone had travelled down every single day to see what happened. The people in the dock, Colin Joyce, Lee Amos and their cohorts knew that they were looking at 30 years or more if they were convicted. And obviously Tyrone's family and Yu Kao's family were anxious for justice. So there was a massive sense of anticipation when the jury came back with their verdicts.
The police had gone to extraordinary lengths to persuade the witnesses to come forward and give evidence. Now, it will be down to the judge and jury to determine the fate of Manchester's most notorious gang.
We're looking at two Manchester gangs separated by over 100 years. The big difference in our two stories comes about during the trial. 100 years ago, the law was harsher. Willen, just 16 years old, was sentenced to death. But then there was an extraordinary turn of events. While Willen was in prison, a petition was signed by thousands of people begging for his reprieve.
What happened to Willen?
There was a huge campaign in Manchester for Billy Willen to be reprieved. It's actually very rare by the late 19th century for an offender as young as 16 to hang. So there was probably some expectation that Willen's life would be spared, but no one could take this for granted. And his family, especially his mother, worked very, very hard to try and rally public support. Thousands of people signed a petition. They're really trying to persuade the Home Secretary to come down on the side of a reprieve.
He was reprieved in the end.
He was reprieved by order of the Home Secretary, and his sentence was commuted from death by hanging to penal servitude for life.
At the last minute, Willen's death sentence was changed to just 8 years imprisonment. It was a compassionate end to the story. But the Home Secretary demanded that the Mayor of Manchester put an end to scuttling. So what did they do?
I think that the Billy Willen case was a wake-up call to Manchester, really. There were a lot of people in Manchester who were so angry with what he'd done that they wanted him to go to the gallows. But there was a counter-argument as well, and newspapers like the Manchester Guardian really were pressing very hard now to say that this is not just the responsibility of one young lad, this is the responsibility of the city to think about why a lad's doing this. Why isn't the city providing better things for them to do?
And they did.
The answer that Manchester came up with was the Working Lads Club movement. These were founded by middle-class, in some cases, evangelical social reformers who actually decided the time has come now to put on new facilities for lads in districts like Ancoats, to give them an alternative to hanging around the streets.
And did the lads find that more attractive than scuttling? I think scuttling sounds pretty attractive in many ways, but...
The younger lads actually really go for the clubs in a big way, and I think what that does is it begins to divert recruits away from the gangs into the clubs. And over 10 years or so, the gangs begin to wither away. So even by the time that Billy Willen comes back to Ancoats in 1900, people are starting to talk about scuttling as a thing of the past.
By 1900, the scuttling gangs had all but vanished. The worst slums were razed and the poor rehoused. New activities appeared, like the cinema, alongside sports clubs where you could try your hand at a bit of boxing or football. One of these schemes resulted in the formation of St Mark's Football Club, now known as Manchester City FC. What we've got here are kids who are exactly the same age that the scuttlers would have been. Kids like Peter Kennedy and Billy Willen. They look pretty tasty too. So, Taggy, tell me about this club. How long has it been here?
It's been here almost, I'd say, about 18 years. It was the old Direct Works. Basically, Joel got it, took a big chance, put his own house up for sale.
This gives kids something to do, gets them off the street, doesn't it? I mean, that's the point of it.
Yeah. I mean, I've always believed that, Gary. What I've always been involved with is sport, whether it's been boxing or football or whatever it's been. And not just for a favoured few. Not just males, even. We are a community-based club.
Do you think this is a real alternative for kids from the gangs? I mean, are kids turned around with this place?
It gives kids that sort of alternative. They can see it, they can be involved in it, it's a part of them. Perhaps in some cases, it's one of the major sort of platforms to give them self-esteem.
You get kids who could have gone the other way, the bad way,
yeah,
who come here and you feel like you've changed them.
Yeah. Well, I think that about all the kids that I've ever known, not just in boxing, although we're talking here about boxing, I think if you give kids anywhere in the world an alternative, something that they can genuinely identify with, want to do, be involved in,
looking at the records from over 100 years ago, you seldom find a clerk or an apprentice being arrested for scuttling. It was always the lads in the huge swathe of society for whom few opportunities existed. These boys had meagre prospects and no political voice or rights. Joining a gang gave them a sense of belonging.
It's no coincidence today, listening to reports of knife and gun crime. They still tend to be clustered in those areas where young people
have fewer educational opportunities.
So what do we do to stop it happening again, you know? Where do we go?
There's no place for the kids them to go because it's like the government or the council closed down loads of the youth centre. So it's like you see most of the kids them hanging about on the street or they'll be sitting in the park and things like that. So there's nothing for them to do. Because some of them can sing, they can rap, they can do all sorts, but what I'm saying, there's no way for them to go to do it. Yeah. And when there's nothing for them to do, what they're gonna do, that's the time they go and do what they don't supposed to do.
After the most extensive investigation in Greater Manchester Police's history, the men who murdered Vivian's son were brought to justice. Colin Joyce was convicted of the murders of Ucal Chin and Tyrone Gilbert. He was told he would spend the next 39 years behind bars. Lee Amos was given a sentence of 35 years. The rest of the gang received a total of 146 years. 11 very dangerous men were removed from the streets of Manchester. Posters aging the faces of Joyce and Amos were put up around the city, making it clear to other young gang members the reality of a 30-year stretch in prison. With the Gooch gang now broken, gun crime in the city fell by almost 60% over the next 2 years. But what's been done to prevent offshoots of the gang, or even another gang entirely, from filling the void? One solution is a movement called Mothers Against Violence. They help build relationships and gain the genuine trust of young people to strengthen their community. I'm going to meet Patsy, who helps run this charity.
Mothers Against Violence started in 1999 when a friend of my son came to me and told me about it because I wouldn't have known about it. And he said, I think you should be there. So I thought, OK, that was like a week after my son was shot and killed.
How long ago was that?
He was killed in 1999, yeah. And within that 10-day period, there was three young men who were shot in different parts of Manchester and were killed, and my son was the second one out of the three. And what happened then, the community started thinking, what's happening? And so a group of mothers decided we needed to do something about it. We started the group and then we started looking at how we can deal with the situation and make our community a better place to live in. We go into prison, we talk to young men who are in prison, we talk to some gang members, we talk to previous gang members. So we're hearing things on the ground all the time. The solution to the problem really is to actually find out what your children are doing.
And what does the future hold for Manchester?
I believe the future is bright for Manchester. I do believe that. I've just come from the police station, really, looking at how we can work together to stop this thing happening again, because it's quite down here. We've not had a death in 3 years. This is, you know, third year. And so we were looking at the people who are locked up now, who's supposed to be coming out soon, and how we're going to be working to make sure that that doesn't start up again. You're there to help and support them. And once they see that, I really believe that's what changes people.
Whether it's a knife attack 100 years ago or a shooting today, gang crime leaves lasting scars. Behind every victim and behind every gang member is a family. And nothing can take away the suffering and the pain of those who have lost their loved ones.
I say, it cannot bring back my son. His life is gone. He's take his life away from me and leave me in pain and agony. It still hurt, but I'm trying not to cry. But sometimes it's hurt. It's hurt. When I'm going to my bed and sometimes I say, why? He should be here. Why he gone? Why they take his life away?
It's horrifying. You know, this is where Tyrone Gilbert's murder happened. I mean, we're standing right where the funeral would have taken place that day. I mean, I can't imagine for one minute what that must have been like. It's just horrific. But I think the work that Pat's is doing over at Mothers Against Violence and also Vivian is doing as well will only help. And there is a light at the tunnel because I think the work that they are doing is proven. At the moment, we're hearing about there's not been a shooting in Manchester for the last 3 years. So let's hope it stays like that.